So I think we're ready to kick off today's session. All right, so let's move forward to slide number 2, and which kind of contains a little bit about the agenda. And as I've mentioned, today's seminar is designed to provide a chance for applicants, potential applicants, to ask questions about the proposal guidelines. Dan and I are going to just give a quick presentation, and then we're going to open up for questions from you. This is not really an introduction to brownfields, nor are we going to go through all the different types of grant funding that's available. So if you are looking for that, we do have some archived sessions from previous Clue-In sessions we've done, and the links are all there. Or you can follow up after the session with Dan or me to get more information on that. Moving to slide 3. Here in the room, as I mentioned, it's Dan and myself. We also have Karen Reed from the Brownfields Program, and Dave Schachterly from Grants Council, and Mike Boydston, also from our legal counsel, to help with any site eligibility questions. So we have, hopefully, among the 5 of us here, we'll be able to answer your questions. On slide number 4, so since 1995, when the Brownfields program got started, we have awarded over 2,200 grants, totaling almost $670 million. We've seen numerous benefits from this investment, assessing almost 14,000 properties, leveraging almost $13 billion, and creating almost 54,000 jobs. Overall, it's a great return on our investment, and we hope with the grant proposals that you all are coming in with that we'll be able to continue with this trend. On slide number 5, this is the amount of funding annually that's available from the Brownfield program on a national level. In this announcement, we are looking at assessment grants, revolving loan fund grants, and cleanup grants. Those are the top 3 there. And about $75 million nationally is available in this announcement. On slide number 6, again, this is for the assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup grants, and we use lots of jargon here, and we call these ARC, which is the first letter of assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup. We also call them our 104K grants. That's the statutory authority that we have for these. So if you hear we use these fairly interchangeably, so if you hear ARC or 104K or our competitive grants, we're all talking about pretty much the same thing. On slide number 7, so last year, EPA received 690 grant proposals. Of that 690, we selected 389. For a total of $111 million in awards. Last year, the funding amount was right around $80 million, but with the stimulus money, we're able to add in and select more grants than we normally do. Right now, we have our normal funding amount of about $75 million, but you never know if additional funding will come through this year. Just something to keep in mind. In Region 8, which is South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, and 27 tribal nations, we received 17 grant proposals, and we were able to fund 9 grants for an award of almost $3.6 million. So that's more than half. We were able to award more than half of the proposals that came in, so we consider that to be pretty good, and we hope to continue with that funding level with this cycle, too. So on slide number 8 is the application timeline. And as you probably know, you may know, on August 13th of this year, that is when we issued the request for proposals for the ARC grants, the Assessment Revolving Loan Fund and Cleanup. They are due on October 16th this year. And you can either submit those proposals hard copy, and there are detailed instructions in the proposal guidelines on how to do that. But one goes to our contractor, and then one also goes to the Brownfields coordinator, Dan Heffernan, here in Region 8. They must be postmarked by October 16th. You can also submit them electronically, and they need to be submitted to us by 11:59 p.m. on October 16th. And just keep in mind, if you are sending them via email, sometimes with attachments, there could be delayed transmissions, or they could be potentially too large for our email files, which is generally over 15 megabytes from non-EPA emails. So just something to keep in mind if you are sending that via email. And then by spring 2010, we will be making the awards for $74 million nationwide. So that's just kind of a brief schedule there. And, okay, on slide number 9, I just want to go through just a little bit about the assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan fund grants. The assessment grants, this is a very popular grant program. Generally, communities apply for these when they're just starting out in the brownfields process, and they really just want to get a lay of the land of what type of issues they have, how many sites they have, and what if any contamination is there on the sites that they have. So these can be community-wide. You can do a number of sites throughout your community, site-specific for just one specific site. We don't get many of those proposals for just assessments on one site. And also, new last year were assessment coalition grants. So I'm just going to go through each one of those real quickly here. Community-wide, up to $200,000 for hazardous substance contamination and $200,000 for petroleum. A lot of communities who think they have both types of contamination come in for both and can receive up to $400,000. On slide number 10, a little bit about site-specific assessment grants, up to $200,000 for petroleum or hazardous substance contamination, and you can get a waiver to up to $350,000 per property. And then the site eligibility and property ownership eligibility would then need to meet the threshold requirements. So, on slide number 11, a little bit about coalitions. There is up to $1 million available for coalitions of three or more eligible entities. You must assess a minimum of 5 sites. And one of the things with coalitions is that it really needs to make sense that the coalition entities are working together. It's not just designed so you can get $1 million and then do some assessments. There really needs to be a natural reason why the entities are working together. For example, they could be contiguous counties in a watershed, or in an urban corridor, or cities along a highway corridor or something like that. A real natural reason on why the coalition members are all working together. So that's just something to keep in mind. On slide number 12, revolving loan fund grants. This is a grant that we give to an eligible entity to who then makes low-interest loans or sub-grants to private developers, to cities, counties, whomever. The idea is we give a grant to you, and then you make loans with that. Key in your proposal is that you can show that there is developer or borrower interest, that somebody actually out there is going to want to take a loan for a cleanup project, and that you also have sites that are ready to go. This is one of the more competitive grant programs, but it's also it's a very successful grant program too, and we were able to achieve a lot of results out of this. New for this year with RLF grants, so only new applicants can apply. In previous years, old or experienced and seasoned RLF grantees have been able to come in for additional grants. They are not eligible in this cycle, so only new ones. So that is great for some of the new RLF applicants that we don't need to compete with. some of the folks out there who have already made numerous loans and have achieved numerous cleanups. Coalitions can apply. In fact, they're encouraged to apply. And there is a cost share requirement with loan fund grants. Also, our cleanup grants, this is not a a hard trick. Just one second.
Someone doesn't have their phone on mute out there. Could everybody make sure to put star six, hit star and six? Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. The cost share requirement is not just a cash match. With RLF grants, it can be passed along to the borrower. It can be met through in-kind time. And it is a fairly flexible, there are many ways to meet the cost share requirements. So let's move forward to slide number 13, which is the cleanup grant program. This is, as the name suggests, for funds, $200,000 available for cleanup activities at brownfield sites. New to this year is that you must own the site at the time of an application. You also have to have done a phase one and a phase two assessment prior to submitting your grant proposal. And the reason for this is that when we award the grant, you are ready to go. You don't have to do any more sampling. There doesn't have to be any property acquisitions. You can start using the money right away and working on your cleanup project. There is a cost share requirement of this of 20%. If you're applying, you can apply for up to three properties. You do need to have a separate proposal for each property. And also, it's really important to take a look at the community notification requirements in the cleanup grant guidelines. This is only for cleanup grants, not for assessment or revolving loan fund. But if you do plan on submitting a cleanup grant application, please look at the community notification requirements. Because it's very specific as to the type of ad you have to have 2 weeks prior to submitting your proposal and getting comment and requesting comments on your proposal and responding to those comments. So I just really encourage you to look at the community notification. And if there are questions on that, I'd be happy to go through it all in detail here once we start the Q&A session. So I'm going to pass it over to Dan to talk about a little bit more about the ARC guidelines, and we'll take it from here.
Thanks, Ted. I'm Dan Heffernan with the EPA here in Denver. We're going to advance to slide 14. Are there folks out there having any technical issues that we need to address? We do have someone on the line who can help with that. You can email in if things aren't working correctly, but I assume if they're not working correctly, you can't email. So just let us know at any time if you're having any problems with the streaming slides. I'm going to just kind of run through the ARC, the Assessment Revolving Loan Fund and Cleanup Guidelines.
Oh, hello, Dan.
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, this is Cynthia from Standing Rock.
Hey, Cynthia.
Hi, are you on, I'm on the phone line, conference call, and I downloaded the PowerPoint presentation, and is it slide 23?
We're on slide 14.
I must have a different PowerPoint because
the same issue. I think the one that was downloaded that was sent to us was last year's.
So when you're at the very first welcome screen to the CLUIN, on the bottom left of the screen there was a go to seminar button. If you selected any of the presentations in the middle of the screen, it would go to a previous archive seminar.
The PowerPoint dated on the right hand side on the bottom is 9/15/2009.
Yep.
Okay, and so the slide 23 that you're looking at, what does it say at the top?
It says cleanup grant program, and it just mentioned everything that Ted mentioned. So I was just wondering if
It's just got extra slides that talk about success stories for each of what you're talking about. That's just the basic difference, I think.
Oh,
if you move forward, well.
Well, the cleanup grant program, it has a bulleted list of 200,000 per property, whatever, three properties, separate, whatever Ted, basically Ted said. But on slide 24, it says success story, cleanup grant, Phillips to the Falls Assessment and Cleanup Grant, Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that happened, Cynthia, because we downloaded it too and we got the correct version. But if you advance to the next slide, what does it say at the top?
Other EPA brownfield programs, job training grant program, targeted brownfield assessment program.
I'm not sure how that happened. Can you advance to the next slide?
When you say next slide, what slide number are you referring to?
Well, slide 14, if you've got the correct version, but somehow
14 says ARC guidelines, layout, and purpose, but the underneath that is blank on mine.
That's the slide that we're hoping people are on.
Thank you.
There aren't that many more slides, so we're just going to go ahead along with the current slides, and we can send them out to you, Cynthia. And sorry about that technical problem.
Oh, okay, that's fine. I kind of know about the program anyway, the cleanup grant. I read the grant guidelines, so I'll just mute my cell phone here. And,
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
Okay, so. We are on slide 14. It's a blank slide that says ARC guidelines at the top. I'm just going to quickly go through the full contents of the guidelines, just kind of the overall layout of them, and then we'll quickly try to get to questions. Please continue to send in questions. There are some coming in so that we can address those at the end. They can be questions about process, the content of the application, site-specific questions you might have, things like that, and we'll try and answer them as best we can. Advancing to slide 15, the proposal guidelines are basically broken into two main sections, one being threshold questions, the other being ranking questions. The threshold questions are must-pass questions. These are primarily legal issues, or they are meant to ensure that your project matches the guidelines parameters that have been set by EPA. A key point on the threshold questions is that they must all be passed in the affirmative. If you cannot pass one of the threshold questions for the type of grant, the proposal will be rejected. Our office will contact you and say, sorry, but you're not going to be considered for the ranking portion of the competition. The other key point on the threshold questions is that our office can answer questions throughout the process on these, so feel free to contact us at any time on threshold questions. For ranking questions, our office cannot answer questions one-on-one because it would bias the competition policy or the competition process. But for threshold questions, please feel free to contact us at any time. Slide number 16. Here are the threshold criteria for each of the three different types of grants. There are three separate requests for proposals, one for assessment, one for revolving loan fund, and one for cleanup grants. So you'll see in the parens there to the right of each criteria which grant types that particular criteria applies to, whether it's all three types or if it's just revolving loan fund and cleanup or just the revolving loan fund. Not all criteria apply to each. And again, if you'd like to go into detail, to hear a detailed explanation of each, please go to one of those archive sessions from last August or September that are on the home screen and that we've provided the web address for. Slide 17, assuming that a proposal has passed all of those threshold criteria, it will then be ranked by a national panel from across the United States based on the four ranking criteria that are listed there. These criteria were revised last year, so if you participated in the Brownfields program at EPA prior to 2009, these will be new criteria to you, or they'll at least be a reshuffled set of criteria for you. The intention was to make it more linear, to kind of have a problem statement, how you'll solve that problem and then what the intended outcome would be. That's the overall mindset you should have throughout writing these proposals, is you need to tie from one section into the next, into the next, into the next, how it all relates to each other. That's how you're going to build the most, the strongest proposal possible. The other main point here is just because you answer a question in one of these four sections, if a similar question is asked in another section, make sure that you answer it under that criterion as well. Don't assume that reviewers are going to be jumping all over the proposal to find where you've answered a particular question. Slide 18. Each criterion is made up of sub-criteria. Answer each of these individually. Stick to the numbering of the proposal guidelines. Make this as simple as possible for the reviewer because they are reviewing a lot of these applications, and you want yours to be as simple for them to review and as clear as possible. The sub-criteria are different. Some of them are the same across the three different grant types, but they may be different, and the point totals are different. EPA wanted to add emphasis by giving different point amounts to different sub-criteria for the three different grant types. You are limited to the number of pages that this proposal can be, so please make sure that you are allowing sufficient amount of space within your proposal to those sub-criteria based on the number of points each is worth. You want to get bang for your buck is what I'm trying to say. Of the 18 pages you get to write in here, make sure that you're getting sufficient space and attention to those criteria that are worth the most points. Slide 19. This is the first of the four criteria. The community need, this is basically where you're giving the problem definition. To the extent you can, please identify health, welfare, environmental, and financial needs and/or problems in the targeted area and how they relate to brownfields in the area. To the extent that you use studies or census data, make sure that you're referencing where that came from. Try to address each of those four four elements of this criteria, health, welfare, environment, and financial needs, as much as possible. Make sure that whatever problems you're identifying here, whatever challenges you're identifying here in this section, you can tie that back in through the next three criteria. You're going to want to be able to always tie what the solution and what the positive outcomes will be back to the problem definition here. Slide number 20. Now that you've defined a challenge, now you're going to describe what your particular project that you're proposing for funding, what that problem is, or what the project will be, and then how you're going to ensure that it's successful. Do you know what you're biting off? These are kind of the questions EPA is going to be, you know, asking as they're reading this. Do you know what you're biting off with this project? Do you have the people, the expertise, the other financial resources to pull off this project that you're proposing? Make sure that the budget in this section is very clear. Follow EPA's budget template. Give a good budget narrative for it. Make sure you pay close attention to prohibited costs that are listed in the budget section of the guidelines under the project description area. Slide number 21. The next section is community engagement and partnership. This is where you're going to talk about how the affected community is going to be engaged throughout this project and who your cooperative partners are that are going to ensure success. Who are you involved in this project in the community? Who are your impacted communities, and how will you effectively involve them throughout the various stages of this project? And then the flip side of that is, who are your partners in this? Who's going to help you throughout the project? And their assistance can be in a number of ways, including in the community engagement component, but it can be in all different aspects as well. So if you do list partners in here, make sure you get letters from them that explain what resources they're bringing to the table that really expresses their commitment to the project. Section 4, this is the final
criteria, of the ranking criteria. This is the project benefits. What are the outcomes going to be of this project? Try to, again, just like you had your problem statement at the community needs section, now at the benefits section, what are the benefits going to be from a public health and safety aspect? What are the economic impacts going to be, the environmental impacts going to be, and how will these things positively impact the affected target community that was identified in the community needs section? How will this project contribute to an overall community vision? Is there a long-range 20-year plan for this city or this county? How will this feed into that? Slide number 23, this is a blank slide, application preparation tips. We're just going to run through a couple of basic what we've learned over the years by reading a lot of these and talking with folks who've written these proposals. So slide 24. Some of these things are universal across any kind of grant application process, so I'm just going to run through them quickly. Make sure you read the entire guidelines and follow the directions. Get mentoring from prior grantees. You see that web address there under the second bullet. You can find phone numbers for everybody we've given grants to in the past and contact communities that have like or similar types of projects to your own. Write the proposal as though the reviewer has no idea about your community or the type of project that you're proposing. Address each criteria, follow the numbering of the EPA guidelines in your proposal. Use the checklist. There's a proposal checklist in the guidelines that's provided just to ensure that you've included every component of the application. And then make sure you don't use acronyms and technical organizational jargon, which is kind of ironic for EPA to be telling you not to use. But, again, that ties back into assuming that the reviewer doesn't know anything about the project you're proposing. Just one or two that are missing from here, like we've mentioned a couple times, we do have a couple of archive sessions from last year that you can go back and listen to. They have some good question and answer at the end of those. And they are available on this CLUIN website. So that's one option, another option that's not on here. Slide 25. These are pretty universal to any kind of federal grant. Make sure that you're using the correct margins. Use your white space. Don't leave big blanks in the page. Do not go over the 18-page limit for the ranking criteria in the two-page cover letter. So that's 20 total pages plus attachments. If you go over those 20 pages, EPA's contractor will remove your excess pages at the end of the proposal, and any critical information you provided in there won't be considered by reviewers. Please limit attachments such as maps and photos. These things will be reproduced a number of times, and it will just turn into a black box of ink and won't be intelligible to the person on the other end. So try not to use any maps or photos. Slide number 26. Make sure that you contact the state or tribal officials who will be impacted or will be involved in your project early and get their input on the project. Contact any partners that you've got or could develop. Contact them early and try to get their buy-in as early as possible. Make sure that you contact your state petroleum office within the Department of Environmental Quality or Department of Health, depending on your state, to get a petroleum determination from them as early as possible. And set up your public meetings and get that meaningful public input as quickly as possible, especially for the cleanup grants. As Ted mentioned before, there's a very strict time frame for that in the proposal guidelines. Make sure that you follow that to the T, and you do that community involvement as early as possible, and you do offer true, meaningful opportunity for public feedback. Slide 27 is a blank slide, more or less. And additional resources, we're just going to throw some web addresses at you, and I'll say a couple things on these, and then we'll be done with those. Slide 28. Slides 28 and 29 are lists of contacts with each state within EPA Region 8. The states are a key partner in brownfields for us. EPA couldn't do our work with local communities without our states. Please feel free to contact these folks early. They know the brownfield program like the back of their hand, and they're happy to help you out. And you do need to get a letter from them. So the sooner you can get them information on your proposed project, the better. That's 28, and slide 29 is additional state contacts within Region 8. Slide 30, this is a new resource this year for applicants. This is the Community Brownfield Foundation. They're also called the Colorado Brownfield Foundation. This organization has they're a sub-grantee. They're part of a grant from EPA to provide technical assistance to communities impacted with brownfields. They're based out of Colorado, but they do work throughout all of EPA Region 8. They're starting to expand quite a bit into working in Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, Utah. Please feel free to contact these folks. The primary point of contact, the executive director, Jesse Silverstein. His contact information is listed there on slide 30. They have extensive expertise. They've worked on projects big and small, for-profit, non-profit. They've worked with local governments. So they're a great resource to contact early, if nothing else, just to brainstorm with these folks and to tap into their connections and examples they've got out there already. Slide number 31. These are some useful websites. The first one is the proposal guidelines, where you can find them online. The second one is a 39-page document of question and answer, frequently asked questions, on the proposal guidelines. We'll be referencing these throughout the question and answer session here today, but we want to make sure people go ahead and go to that website if you're going to apply, and I think a lot of your questions will be answered there. Again, there are archived presentations there on bullet number 3. Bullet number 4 is our website, which we think is a good portal for finding information on brownfield, all aspects of the brownfield world. Bullet number 5, SMART-E, is another website that has lots of very useful information for communities, local governments on revitalization efforts, including brownfields. Then that final one, TAB-EZ, that's the final bullet there. TAB-EZ is an online tool that was developed by a grantee from EPA to assist folks who are applying for brownfields grants. So it's kind of a tutorial and walks folks through the actual application process. I've never used this because I've never applied for a brownfield grant, but my understanding is that the TAB-EZ tool can be used, and when you're done going through the process, you basically have the outline of a proposal written. So this is a really good free online tool that you may want to consider. And also on that TAB-EZ, there was a clue-in tutorial on this same website yesterday, September 14th, on the TAB-EZ tool that you may want to listen to an archive of if you're considering using it. And with that, slide number 32, we're going to open it up for question and answer. Like we said, please feel free to submit your questions online by hitting the little question mark at the top of your screen, or you can unmute your phone and fire away at us, and we'll attempt to answer them as best we can. And then once EPA has answered them, we ask folks on the line if they have experience or feedback to chime in as well, make a real conversation. So with that, I'll open it up.
All right, well, this is Ted again, and we do have one question online. We hope to have a few more. So but the first question is, and I'm just going to read it, it's from Montana, and the question is, our coalition was unsuccessful with our assessment grant application in 2009, but will submit another request this year. Do we need to get all new letters of support, or will those dated in 2009 suffice? And you will need to get new letters of support. I think one of the things the readers will see if you use the old letters of support as well, are these organizations still supporting your grant proposal and your efforts? So, yep, you will need to get new letters of support. And also, just to expand on that, I think it's important in these letters and then also in the proposal guidelines where you talk about the partnerships, is to really identify these organizations' specific interest in the project. Not just that they think it's a great idea, but how will they benefit? How are they involved? What resources are they bringing to the table? So I think that can just strengthen both the letters of support as well as the description of your partnerships that you have. So hope that answers your question. We don't have any other ones online, so we'll just open up the phones if folks have questions.
And you can just press #6 to unmute your phones if you've followed the instructions from the teleconference line.
Come on, there have to be a few questions out there.
I've read these guidelines. They're not that clean, that clear.
Right.
There's got to be some questions
right
out there.
Hello, Ted.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I had a question. This is just about the census data. I mean, it's kind of old. I mean, when you go onto that website, remember, because the census is just not coming around again. And usually they only have those MSA data that is current. And I don't know. Do we have to use just census.gov? Or there's a BIA census that was information about population and poverty and economic data figures. Is that allowable, or there's, other than that, there's a tribal one also. And, you know, all these numbers are so skewed. They're so different from each other. It's just, I don't know, do we just use the census? I know a lot of federal programs, they just recommend using the census.gov website.
Right,
but
well,
it's not current.
Yeah, good question. And, in the proposal guidelines, in your community needs section, there's a section where you talk about some of the demographic data for your community.
Mm-hmm.
And we encourage you to look at the demographic data for the specific target community, your city, state, tribe, and can also compare it to a national average. So you're going to need to get some census data from that. And really, the best bet, Cynthia, I think, is just to use whatever information you have that's the most current and that you think is the most reliable, and then just cite the source that you have. If the census data isn't totally current, then that'll probably be fine. Or if there's BIA information, I would just defer to you on what you think is the most accurate, and then just cite the source.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
We've got a question here from someone in Colorado about the number of applicants we're anticipating from Colorado for this competition. We don't know. We've got a preliminary list of folks who have expressed interest, and we kind of try to keep a running tally. Do you think we're going to get good participation this year in this program in this part of the country, including Colorado? Right now we've got leads on 4 or 5 projects in Colorado that look like they're going to apply. But, you know, we've got close to, if not above, 50% success rates in this program within EPA Region 8, as opposed to roughly 30 to 35% national success rates in getting these proposals funded. So, of course, our goal is to get more applications out of EPA Region 8 and get more projects going on the ground. And I think we're moving in that direction, but... You know, we want to encourage folks to continue to apply. We've got fairly high success rates. So what other questions are out there?
Come on, there have to be a few more.
There'll probably be more project-specific ones later on.
I Okay, that's fine. We welcome those as well.
Questions on coalitions, questions on trends from last year, anything like that is all fair game.
I've got one then.
Okay, great.
What about the ones that were not accepted? Were there usually some general reasons why they weren't accepted, or is it just the way the application was done, or what was that? Is that a real question?
Yeah. It's a tough one, though, because, with, 600 and some proposals, I can't remember how many Ted said, and only half of them or so getting funded last year, there were a number of reasons why they didn't. Some of those best practices that I ran through as far as, following the format, making sure that following the format of the guidelines, making sure that each section of the ranking criteria feeds into the next section and ties back to the previous section. Those are the kind of things that the more you can do that, the simpler you can make it for the reviewer, and the more you can draw contiguous story from one section to the next, the stronger your proposal is going to be, regardless of how many cubic feet of soil you plan to move, or regardless of the poverty rate and the locale that you're going to work in and things. So there's not one particular problem area.
And just to expand on that, it is tough to answer this one, but sort of a general rule that we see is that, some of the proposals that get funded really have a well-thought-out plan, and there's also community buy-in on that plan. And we can sort of identify that plan based on some of the linkages between those four ranking criteria sections. So in the community need, you talk about what the community needs, what the problem is. And then in the project description, you say, well, here's how we're going to solve part of this problem. Here's how we're going to address this problem. And then the community engagement, these are the communities that are involved that are going to help us do this. And then the project benefits, you talk about the benefits of all of this and how, again, it's all linked back to the community need and the project description. So there's a nice flow among the different elements. I don't know if any of the other folks in the room here want to expand on that.
This is Dave Shackley. In terms of one change that is different from last year that bears repeating if it hasn't already been mentioned is, for cleanup grants, you have to have property ownership at the time of the project or of the proposal submission. And that's a major change from last year, which I think is going to affect the competition as well, because in years past, you didn't have to actually own the property. There were certain dates you had to take property by. This year, you're going to have to actually own the property.
And that is for cleanup grants only.
Cleanup grants only.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure. All right, we do have another question online here, and I'm just going to read it. It is from Colorado, and it is, what can cities that own brownfield properties do to get funding for the sites they own? In other words, how can they demonstrate site eligibility for sites they may have purchased? Some of these purchases were well-intended, land bank, et cetera, but may not have strictly followed all appropriate inquiry. I don't know if...
This is Mike at Boydston, and it's pretty hard to address that without looking at the specific circumstances of the site. All appropriate inquiry is a legal standard that we have to live with. But, I don't know how much more I can say than that. Do you have any thoughts?
The only other thought on that, this is Dan Heffernan, is the all appropriate inquiry rule, you've really got to pay attention to the dates, the date requirements. So that does impact the standard that you're being held to, or the standard practice of the day that you're being held to. So if we're talking about a land purchase, from, you know, 1996. That's drastically different than what is required in 1998, which is totally different than what's required yesterday. So it gets fairly complicated. But if the bottom line is, if you've got an entity that's taking property, you know, in 2009 right now without doing their all appropriate inquiry phase one prior, and then, you know, doing any required continuing obligations and necessary reasonable steps afterward, there's not much hope for ever getting them EPA funds to help with the, you know, their assessment or cleanup needs down the road. It's a pretty hard and fast rule at this point.
I guess the only other thing I can think of is that all appropriate inquiry is not the only conceivable way that you could argue that you're not a liable party despite being the owner. But in practice, it does tend to be involved in most cases. It's just, I wouldn't rule it out for all circumstances that there could be some other explanation or justification for not being liable.
The next question is, again, related to all appropriate inquiry. And the question is, all appropriate inquiry is required for cleanup grants. If all appropriate inquiry was done 2 years ago and nothing has changed at the site, will another all appropriate inquiry be necessary? And this is, of course, the depends. It depends answer. If the site was purchased 2 years ago, when that all, you know, subsequent to that all appropriate inquiry, if that site was then purchased within 6 months of that phase one of all appropriate inquiry assessment, then no, you wouldn't need to do another phase one all appropriate inquiry assessment just for this grant purpose. That would suffice. If, on the other hand, an all appropriate inquiry assessment was done 2 years ago and the site wasn't purchased at that time, and now you're going to go back, say City X is going to go back and purchase that site now, then they would have to update that all appropriate inquiry. They would have to go do an updated phase one, which they could use the previous one to feed a lot of the information for, but they would have to, regardless, have an updated all appropriate inquiry phase one. Does that answer the question? Okay. Because there is a requirement for the cleanup grants that a phase one assessment be done, and all appropriate inquiry phase one be done, but that's that's one issue. The other issue is the actual liability and whether or not the applicant is eligible for the grant. And so it really is kind of a question in time on this one. Other questions out there, feel free to unmute and throw them out there. You got questions about trends at EPA or what reviewers are looking for or how the assessment coalitions went last year as far as folks getting selected?
Sure, go ahead and tell us.
Which one?
What they're looking for.
What reviewers are looking for? Again, they're reviewing a lot of these, and this is on top of their normal workload. And so what they're looking for is a very clear, concise, linear proposal with a very well-defined problem statement, with as many commitments as possible throughout the proposal. So to the extent you can get letters from other organizations that say they support your project, that's great. If you can get letters that say other organizations will voluntarily give up meeting space or provide funding for picking up litter around sites in the area or whatever, that's better. To the extent you could say your organization has leveraged lots of dollars in the past that can go towards this kind of project, that's good. To the extent you can say your organization will dedicate half of a person or half of an FTE and $200,000 to this project, that's better. So they're looking for real commitments. And then the last thing that reviewers are really looking for. You know, you've got a defined problem, you've got a good project that you'd like to do. They're really looking for what are the extra things that you're willing to do? What are the extra things your organization is willing to commit to here? Are they willing to commit to a new leadership and environmental and energy design requirement for future development on the area? Are they willing to commit to innovative site cleanup techniques? Are they willing to commit to other things environmentally related, energy and environmentally related, that go above and beyond what are required in here? And to the extent that you can tie this into larger efforts towards sustainable communities, towards energy efficiency, things of that nature, you're really going to do well with EPA reviewers in a grant proposal. So that's one that's probably not real clear in a grant guidelines. But
okay, so then what about the trends that you mentioned?
I mentioned a few of them there at the end. Really what we're trying to do as an agency is leverage these brownfields grants to get as many other environmental goods, kind of in quotations, as possible. So to the extent that, you know, your city has signed on to a carbon plan for carbon emission reduction for 2030 or whatever it might be, tie this into that. Brownfield infill redevelopment is a major component of vehicle miles traveled, reduced vehicle miles traveled. It's a major component of reusing infrastructure and such. So those are the kind of things that, you know, if you're willing to put on a diesel emission reduction requirement on a project, if you say you're proposing cleanup, a revolving loan fund grant, if you're willing to require the contractor to have an idle reduction policy for diesel, put that in here. So those are some of the trends. EPA is really trying to see what more they can get applicants to propose above and beyond just dealing with brownfields contamination and redevelopment in their area.
Thank you.
Yeah. What else?
Okay, so we just wanted to follow up with another question online here, and this is a follow-up from the previous question, and it's and I'm just going to read it again here, and it says, our response sort of answers my question. However, in this case, the all-appropriate inquiry was done after purchase by the state as part of a brownfield assessment done by the state using our assessment grant monies. And I think, you know, one of the things in order to be eligible for brownfields funding is that the all-appropriate inquiry needs to be done within 6 months prior to purchase. So, you know, we would have to look at a lot of the specifics of this particular case, but in order to be eligible and meet that all-appropriate inquiry, it needs to be done before the purchase. I don't know if the folks in the room want to expand on that at all.
Yeah, and kind of like Mike said earlier, the one exception to that, or one of the primary exceptions to that in the brownfields world, is involuntary acquisition by a local government. So if we're talking about a local government here and they took this piece of property to protect public health, they took it through involuntary tax delinquency, something of that nature, that would be another factor that would factor in here that you'd want to contact EPA on and have us help think through that scenario and whether or not the site is applicable for brownfields and eligible.
All right, what else? If you have a specific question about your proposal, it'll probably help other communities out there listening in, so don't be bashful.
I've got one, but it's not necessarily about a specific property, but a property that I anticipate. But it's more general. For a rookie who has never applied yet, but fully intends to and expects to for a particular site, what type of time frame, maybe this is really super basic question, but what type of time frame and what type of expectations should I have about this process?
So the EPA proposal review piece or the actual doing the project on the ground?
Start to finish. I mean, say I've got a property, I acquire a property, during due diligence, I mean, I already know it's going to need cleanup, so I'm not going to be eligible for this year because it's not acquired yet. I don't own it, but I will. I mean, is it? I'm thinking I want to start the process since now, so that the moment you issue the RFP next year, I can apply. But once I apply and get through the application process, I mean, is there a timeline?
Yeah, Ted kind of briefly hit on it early on. I don't know if slide 4 or 5 there, but basically we issue a request for proposals in the late summer, this time frame each year. Proposals are then due in October this year and somewhere around there each year. Then EPA takes a couple of months to work through those threshold questions that we mentioned before, and then we go through extensive ranking panel processes throughout the winter. The announcement is generally made of who's getting selected in the March timeframe. So you submitted a proposal in, let's say, October. Now we're in March or April, and that's when EPA generally announces who's getting the funding. And then to actually, then there's a bunch of paperwork. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's a lot of paperwork because you're entering into a contract with the federal government. And by the time all that paperwork is done, it's generally August or so. So you're talking about 9 months or so start to finish, 10 months or so start to finish, writing a proposal, getting selected, and then actually having the grant funds in hand to be used on a site. After that, if we're talking about cleaning up a piece of property, you're a nonprofit or a local government, you've taken ownership of a piece of property and now you want to clean it up, then there, throughout that winter, you've now got the funds in hand. Throughout that winter, you're going to be doing your cleanup planning, looking at alternatives, having public meetings around those alternatives. And then probably realistically ready to actually move dirt in the spring time frame, depending on, you know, how far north or how far south you are in the United States and whether your ground is frozen or not. So I don't know if that helped or not.
That was perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, it totally varies as far as how far along you are in the process, how much you've engaged the state that you reside within or this piece of property resides within, because really the state becomes the, in the vast majority of these projects, the state becomes the primary regulatory oversight body for the actual cleanup work. So to the extent they've already been engaged, they know the project that you're doing, they've provided feedback, that's going to speed things up quite a bit. So again, that kind of back to early notice, in trying to get as much buy-in as possible from the state you're in.
Perfect. Appreciate that.
Okay, great. We have a question online here, and I'm just going to read it. It is from Portland, Oregon. And the question is, do you know if there is going to be a Western Regional Brownfields Conference in the near future? And just to give a little background, we normally have a Western Brownfields workshop every year with Regions 8, 9, and 10. And we're not having one this year because we have the National Conference, the National Brownfields Conference in New Orleans in November, and we thought it would just be too many conferences if we also had a Western conference this year as well. So we're planning on having one next fall of 2010. It's going to be somewhere in Region 8 this year. We're kind of figuring out exactly where it'll be, either Utah, Colorado, South Dakota, Montana, kind of the states that we're thinking about, but we're open to suggestions if you have any. So that's a, hopefully that answers your question on the Western Brownfield workshop.
Yeah, just to follow on to that, in the Brownfields world, especially if you're kind of new to it, it's very important to network as much as possible and not reinvent wheels, because it is fairly complex. There are a lot of aspects to the Brownfields assessment, cleanup, reuse. And so to the extent you can tap into folks who've done it before, it's really important. Conferences are a good way to do that networking and to hear best practices. The National Conference in New Orleans this year is a massive conference. We hope a lot of you will participate in that. But we do try to have a Western regional conference, and we are going to be hosting it sometime next year, 200 to 400 participants, somewhere in that range. So the locale has to be able to accommodate, conference space and hotels-wise, a fairly large number of people. So we're trying to work that out right now, and we'll get information on that as soon as possible out to people.
I have another rookie question.
Great.
The process that you just kind of reviewed for me, you talked about the time frame in which we could start moving dirt. Is there a required time frame once the award has been given? Is there a required time frame in which that dirt must begin?
So the award is a three-year cooperative agreement, but people call it a grant generally between EPA and the organization, whoever it is. So it's a three-year agreement. Anywhere within that 3 years is agreeable. With that said, there are some substantial progress requirements in the terms and conditions of, you know, getting some of the steps done. And you work with EPA one-on-one with the EPA project manager to work on making that substantial progress. But, no, there's not a requirement that, you know, contractors be on site within 3 months or 6 months or something. What we want to make sure is that all the necessary steps to do a sufficient cleanup that's protective of the local community and has, you know, is long-term going to be a sound cleanup are done. And there are a number of steps in that process, and it takes time before dirt ever moves to ensure that the project's done right.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
And just to expand on that a little bit, revolving loan fund grants are five-year grants. Assessment and cleanup are three. And if you find yourself needing more time on some of these, we can do extensions on them. So.
Okay.
Other questions, thoughts, tips for other folks who are on the line, for people who've done this in the past? It's a substantial time investment. Building all these partnerships that EPA wants to see, writing a lengthy proposal, just applying for this is a real commitment. I think you can maximize this effort for your community. If possible, applying for different grant types within here. You've got a site that's ready to be cleaned up, also applying for an assessment grant for another area. Things of that nature, just to get the most bang for your buck when you're actually writing the proposal, because so many of the sections are, you know, copy and paste from one of the grant types to the next. That's just one suggestion I have for folks who might have various types of brownfield efforts in there.
Can site assessment grants be used to prepare bid specifications or remedial designs?
Yeah, EPA generally, for better or worse, will oftentimes call that like phase three work of assessment, cleanup planning. And in general, yes. The answer is generally yes. You can develop cleanup plans and look at alternatives and things with assessment grants. But you're going to want to check on one-on-one with the project manager for any assessment grant to make sure it fits within the scope of the, you know, the work plan agreement with EPA. And just to make sure that we're not getting too close to actually conducting cleanup work on the site. But we have to make sure that there are some boundary lines between the grant types and the activities under them. But in general, yes.
Is it possible also to get a copy of the agreement that is, you know, sent to the awardees, you know, after the grant's approved?
So the cooperative agreement between EPA and...
Yeah, I mean, do you have, like, a boilerplate that is you know, something we could look at in advance just to kind of help understand what is and isn't expected of the grant awardees?
Yeah, the act, so as far as what might be of interest to folks, I think it's primarily two things, what we require in a work plan, for each of the different grant types, because, you know, specifically for a cleanup grant, we have some very specific steps that have to be integrated into the project and have to be followed before that dirt moves, for example. So the work plan requirements we do have a template of, and then the terms and conditions that are attached to grants, we try to be as clear as possible in the guidelines in the addendum in the back of the guidelines as far as what terms and conditions will be included, but they're fairly extensive conditions and they're, you know, worth knowing that they're going to be attached to a proposal. So those are Freedom of Information Act releasable documents that you can ask EPA for at any time via our website.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else?
Am I muted?
We can hear you.
Hello, I have a question for Dan. This is Steve Jackson, Assistant Wahpeton Oyate, and or for you, Ted. The money that's going to become available for 2010 on the art grants, is that going to be ARRA funds, or is it going to be regular congressional appropriations EPA funding?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. This is Ted, and it's just going to be regular money. It's not going to be stimulus or ARRA money.
Okay.
The stimulus was just associated with the last cycle, and some of them were stimulus grants, some of them were regular. But for this cycle, as far as we know for now, they're all going to just be regular money. So.
I did notice that there was a 20% match in there. So, thank you, Ted.
Thanks.
And this is Chris Shackley. The other thing you want to do is make sure that your stimulus money doesn't touch your regular money. You want to keep those dollars separate project-wise as well as financially separate.
Yeah, so that would be for any folks out there who have economic stimulus brownfield money. Make sure you're working very closely with the EPA project officer on being very clear about those stimulus dollars and what they're being used for and any other grant funds you might have. Any last thoughts or questions out there?
Just a comment. Thanks for hanging out well to draw questions out of us. Have been helpful.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. And to kind of to that point, there is a feedback questionnaire on the website here to let us know what would be useful going forward. You know, we are environmental professionals. We're not, you know, communication experts. So we're trying to communicate in ways that are useful for folks and are sensitive to your time constraints and so any kind of feedback along those lines of going forward, things that you think would be helpful, is much appreciated.
Will do. You guys did a good job. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Well, if there aren't any further questions, we'll conclude today's session. And just to follow up, feel free to call Dan or myself anytime. Our contact information is on the website or I think also in our presentation, an email is fine too. We'd be happy to work with you on any follow-up questions. So thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.